Welcome back to another week of Behind the Lens. I'm Debbie Elias, film critic, creator, and host of Behind the Lens, where we go behind the lens and below the line with all those movers and shakers, those film and TV and streaming makers, the producers, directors, writers, actors, cinematographers, production designers, costume designers, film editors, sound editors, mixers, and designers. Those VFX gurus, composers, stuntmen and women, and so many more. And of course, you know how much I love to talk, and you know how much I love film. So that makes me love doing this show for all of you every week. Just so joyous. Between floods and ceiling collapses and incompetent contractors, doing this show every week for you, gives me pure joy, and I thank you for letting me do it all these years. Because, of course, don't we all want to know more about the who, what, why, when, where, and how of movie making? So, it's a fun show this week on BTL Radio Show, and that's thanks to director Alicia McDonald talking about her new film opening on Friday, Finding Emily. Absolutely wonderful rom-com that brings British romantic comedies back to the forefront. And of course, we've got writer-director Casper Kelly discussing his new film, Buddy, which also opens in theaters this Friday. So, I'm going to start you off a little easy. First up, we're going to go to Manchester, England with Finding Emily. Directed by Alicia McDonald, it is her feature directorial debut, and written by Rachel Hirons. Finding Emily is the story of a lovesick musician named Owen who's given the wrong number for his dream girl named Emily, which leads him to team up with a driven psychology student from the United States, also named Emily, but she is Emily Rain, who helps Owen find his dream Emily. Now, together, they spark a hilarious campus-wide frenzy that tests their own hearts and ambitions along the way. Now, there are 40,000 students at the university. There are 318 that are named Emily, plus some non-students, as in administrators and staff, who are also named Emily. And Owen's ideas for finding the right Emily bring on all sorts of hilarity and heart. And I have to say, Spike Fern is Owen. Nguri Rice is Emily Rain. These two are perfect together. And Spike is just, oh my God. He's so nerdy and geeky, and you just love him. And you root for him to figure out how to navigate this world to find his dream girl. Minnie Driver also stars in the film as the hard-nosed Dean Emily Watkinson of the university. And as I said, this is truly a revival of the British romantic comedy, and it is firing on all cylinders with a youthful energy while tackling themes of how to be romantic in today's world, dealing with emotional messiness, starting fresh as you move into the next chapter of your life, aka adulting. Because here we are, college, everybody's like 20, 21, and especially poor Owen, he still doesn't even know how to ask a girl out or get her correct phone number or all the digits of her phone number. But I digress. This, as I said, this is Alicia's feature directorial debut. You would never know it to see the film. This is a crafts-heavy film that fully creates and immerses us in this collegiate world, while embracing Manchester and the UK, and celebrating the individual Emilies we meet along the way. And boy, do we meet a lot of Emilies, especially after Owen sends an email to every Emily in this attending the school, and he doesn't know how to do a BCC. Does that give you a clue as to Owen's capabilities? Now, as Alicia explains in this exclusive interview, the primary goal for Finding Emily was to create an authentic, honest, romantic comedy with a quote-unquote indie soul rather than a glossy studio feel. and she succeeds. Thanks to Rachel Clark's cinematography and visual grammar with resulting visual tonal bandwidth, Bobby Cousins' wonderful production design and color scheme, Sarah Hazan's costuming, which informs and defines characters, so important when you have 318 Emilys running around and you don't have the time for exposition for each one of them. One look at their costuming and hair and makeup, and you know who they are. You know who that girl is. Also, in the mix, incredible editing by Phil Hignett, who had to find the funny and balance comedic beats with serious emotion and develop perfect pacing that actually has a cadence that fits the film's score by Morgan Kibbe, along with a plethora of fantastic needle drops from local Manchester bands. By film's end, I guarantee you'll feel like you're in college and actually fitting in with the Gen Z crowd. Alicia and I cover it all and more. So take a listen as Alicia McDonald discusses Finding Emily. Alicia, congratulations on such a fun, energetic, and adorable film.
Thank you so much.
I had so much fun watching Finding Emily. It's fresh, it's funny. That youthful energy, though, is just so fantastic because it permeates the entire film. And I have to say, hats off to you and all of your department heads, your DP, Rachel Clark, Phil, your editor, your composer, Morgan Kibbe, and of course your production designer, Bobby, and your costumer, Sarah, along with the hair and makeup, because what you have done, we are embedded in this world. You don't waste any exposition on creating the world. You let the hair and the costuming individualize each person. We know who they are in one look. So everything keeps moving along smartly. Everybody, we get a glimpse of all of the Emilys and all of their individuality. This is all the detail that you put into this to define this world is so fantastic. I can't thank you enough for doing that.
Thank you so much. I love that you picked up on all of the detail because well, everyone worked so hard, as you say, in each specific department to make sure that it was layered and textured and just full of life, which was the sort of pitch from the beginning was we were going to try and make an authentic, real, honest romantic comedy that felt like the characters were people in the real world rather than just people in a movie, and that the space felt real. And I guess that it had a sort of indie spirit. I was aware we were making a studio, but my pitch from the beginning was I wanted it to have an indie soul, really. And so hence, actually, all of the heads of department were kind of indie. They're sort of from indie backgrounds. No one had done big glossy movies, which were obviously myself included, and that was the pitch. So it was, yeah, it's great. I'm so thrilled you like it. I love hearing that.
Those details, I mean, I felt like I was in a college town, in a college world with all of these individuals. But you mentioned, you brought up a key word there, Alicia, and that's glossy. And this, God love you and Rachel Clark for this, with your visual grammar, your design of the grammar, your visual tonal bandwidth. This doesn't feel like you took a digital camera and turned it on and got it as glossy as you possibly could. This has a wonderful anamorphic feel to it, which really plays into the almost analog mindset of Owen. Nerdy geekiness, very analog. He doesn't know what a BCC is on a text message. He doesn't know how to do a heading on an email, dear ladies, I don't think so. But the look, the finish of the film, the texture, the cinematic grain and texture, it has an anamorphic feel and not this high gloss, highbrow look to it. And that takes us deeper into the whole collegiate world and the grounding that makes it feel so real. So, I mean, just beautiful the way you guys have done that. Was that intentional on the part of you and Rachel?
Yes, 100%. My pitch to her was, because when I first came onto it, I was like, oh man, a rom-com, like they all look so glossy and shiny, and I didn't want to make one of them. And that was my pitch to Rachel, was like, let's make it feel gritty and real and nostalgic and quite traditional. You know, we shot it quite, there's lots of two shots. I didn't want loads of coverage. We wanted to build the chemistry and make it feel like anything could happen and create that kind of tumbling momentum. And with Phil, the editor, we worked a lot on that momentum and pacing. And yeah, the look of it, I mean, I feel like we all, well, I definitely have become a little desensitized to a lot of the super glossy, shiny things. And it creates a blockage, I think, from feeling anything if you're an audience, because you're connected. So yeah, it was a huge plan from the beginning. It was no kind of big sweeping crane shots with, like, you know, that are synonymous with these kind of films. I wanted it to feel as real as possible, and Rachel was incredible with that. And she's so her happy place is doing handheld, and that adds such an energy as well. She's a really balletic camera person, and it was just heaven for us to make it feel like an indie, and that was the spirit and the look of the whole thing.
Well, and I'm glad that you mentioned handheld, because I was going to ask you, because the fluidity of the camera, especially in a college atmosphere again, because students are going here, there, and everywhere, and you're bouncing all over Manchester as you're filming. You've got club scenes, you've got this, that, and the other. Nothing is stationary. And with the handheld, it really lets you hone in on those two shots, be it Owen trying to connect with Fairy Emily, or Owen with his dealings with his wonderfully morally complex and smart bestie, Emily Rain. I love how that helps develop and solidify relationships. Even the two shots in the dean's office with the dean's secretary, who is hilarious. She's totally unemotional and snarky. And her face doesn't move. It's like it's been Botoxed from here to Kingdom Come. But she's got this snarky tone. But even there, you're honing in on a two-shot, maybe a little wider two-shot, when you get Owen and her in the shot together. But I love that visual grammar that you guys came up with.
I'm so pleased, because it was well thought out, and it was a plan, and I'm thrilled that you noticed it. I think the whole thing contributes to this quite traditional feeling of also just letting the actors play, you know, like just give them the space to play and do their thing, because the cast are incredible, and we wanted to just give them the freedom to impact each other and react together, especially Spike and Angari. The two of them are such gorgeous actors, and they're so different to each other. Their physicality is completely different, and watching them interact together in a two-shot was just my definite favorite thing.
Yeah, they're almost like oil and water from a physicality standpoint. But then you put them together, and they're a perfectly blended salad dressing.
That's gorgeous. Yeah, exactly.
They're wonderful, wonderful to watch. How important, because I see color is defining many things in this film, how important was your color palette here, and how difficult was it to come up with a color palette that would work for this film?
I think it was quite clear, I think, from the beginning. Like, Rachel's so clever, and because we wanted it to feel real but sort of contrasty, I guess, there was a sort of saturation element, but we didn't want it to feel too euphoria cool, you know what I mean, in terms of the youth, but there had to be a warmth to it because of the comedy. So it was a complicated thing, I guess, because for comedy you can't be too dark, but we wanted it to feel, like I say, like indie and real, and like a sort of, as you say, like a proper campus that can be a bit gritty, and so it was a real balance. And Jatine, our colorist, was incredible at getting that right. But it feels like it was because we planned it from the beginning. It sort of everything kind of came along with that, and Bobby and Sarah doing costume and production design, you know, were great with that, and put all of this color and texture into the costumes, as you say, and that detail. So we were kind of all working together all the time.
You had a big balancing act going on here, and at the end, that balancing act fell into the hands of Phil Hignett, and I don't know how he pulled this off, but found the funny, found the heart. The challenge of this edit for the two of you, balancing the comedic beats with the serious emotion, finding a pace, and a pace that also fits Morgan Kibbe's musical cadence. This could not have been easy for you and Phil.
It wasn't easy, but it was also the time of our lives. I loved the edit so much. So me and Phil had done a couple commercials together previously, and like comedy. So I directed a bunch of comedy anyway, and that's what he does. So I wanted him to do this film because I knew that that we could sit in a room together for the best part of a year, and figure it out. And I think he loves the film almost as much as I do, and it was a complicated balance, but also I feel like we were just always trying to make each other laugh and try and make it, I guess with the balance, as you say, it is a balancing act. And I look back now and it feels, it's always that thing is when you look at it now, you're like, it could only ever have been this way. But there was a lot of trial and error. And the music, the score was so important for adding that heart and level of soul that the film really needs, because we did a lot of commercial tracks and the music. Yeah. I've been making this playlist forever that we were kind of working from and finding new things, but the score really pulled it together, and Morgan was so amazing at that because she found this real soul and heart that just made me weep. The first time she played me the track that Owen runs to, that piano, mm-hmm. she's just, yeah, so cool. It absolutely made me cry my eyes out. She's amazing.
Well, and it's never an easy task when you're, for a composer, when you also have to worry about the needle drops that are being pumped throughout, because you've got to make it all cohesive, and that score is usually what's going to tie it all together. And you have such an eclectic blend of needle drops happening here. I want a soundtrack. I want a soundtrack, Alicia.
And we've got a soundtrack. There is a vinyl available. Well, that was the thing, because Manchester, you know, some of the biggest bands in the world have come out of there, New Order, Oasis, Stone Roses. And so I felt a real responsibility to get the music right, but I didn't want to just use, you know, the old guard. There are so many new, exciting musicians coming out of Manchester that are not just guitar bands. There's a lot of electronic and spoken word, and I wanted all of that in there, because that's what happens when you go from bar to bar or venue to venue. There's all these different kinds of music being played. So I wanted that to feel part of our soundscape, because it felt real to the city. And then, yeah, as you say, Morgan, it was a difficult job. We did lots of different ways with her, but I think where we landed is so exciting. And yeah, I love it.
Yeah, musically, I love it. And I'm glad to know that there's something I can spend money on. I can go buy another vinyl. That makes me happy, Alicia. Now, I know, because they've already given me the sign that we've got to wrap, but I just want to clarify. Is this your first feature directorial?
Yes, it is.
That's what I thought. It belies this, the end result of Finding Emily belies this being your first feature directorial. So very quickly, can you tell me, what is the greatest lesson that you learned about yourself in directing Finding Emily that you can now take forward into future projects?
I put so much of myself into this film that I don't know if it's a lesson, but it's something that I realized the difference between making TV and making a film is so much of my own heart and soul and experiences and sort of dynamics all went into it. And it's an amazingly vulnerable and raw and exposing experience. But yeah, I didn't realize how much of myself I would put into this film at the start. And I think that's also what you have to do as a director. So I know now going forward that I'll have to do that again, but it's an emotional process of doing that and then letting it go at the end. So that's, I guess, what I learned.
Well, I can't wait to see what you bring us next in the feature department. I want to see more from you. And I hope we get to chat again in the future, Alicia.
Yeah, me too. It was so nice to speak to you. And thank you for being so enthusiastic. It means the world.
Oh, thank you. And you have a great rest of your day.
Well, you too. See you soon.
Bye-bye. And that was director Alicia McDonald talking Finding Emily, which is exclusively in theaters this Friday, August 28th. And as you heard Alicia tell me, there is a soundtrack out, and it's in vinyl. So yay on that. And once you see the film, you're going to want to get the soundtrack, I guarantee you. Especially a press colleague of mine, Lula Maybell, Courtney Howard, a new soundtrack on vinyl for you to go buy. She has an incredible vinyl collection. So she needs to put this on her must-buy list. But shifting gears, get ready for a fun-filled look into the world of Buddy, courtesy of writer-director Casper Kelly. I had so much fun watching this film and speaking with Casper about it. Buddy is very cool, fresh, original, a novel idea. It's kooky. I can't even come up with all the words for this film, other than to say I really love it. So just who is Buddy? Well, Buddy is a bright orange unicorn and star of the imaginary classic children's television show who brought joy and life lessons into your living room. Now, most of the younger generation, you're all immediately going to think of Barney as a touchstone. This goes back much further, back to the days of the early 70s of New Zoo Review, and even earlier than that, to the infancy of children's programming at the local television levels, most notably where credited with starting it is in Philadelphia. And I'm so happy that I was there for the start of that, and my dad was part of it. But so this is who Buddy is. But Casper takes us inside the world of the show It's Buddy, where we meet a group of children who spend their days singing, dancing, and helping Buddy spread happiness while learning important life lessons. But what happens when one child refuses to play along, displeasing and angering the orange Buddy? Buddy may invite the easy shorthand of R-rated Barney, as I said, but the film Casper reaches much farther back, and truly, the real spiritual kinship lies with Ernest in the brightly colored programming of the 60s and 70s, especially New Zoo Review, with its anthropomorphic characters, songs, moral lessons, and unapologetically theatrical world-building. Y'all remember Henrietta Hippo? Along with the handmade fantasy worlds of Sid and Marty Croft. Now, Casper understands that world well enough to know that the surest way to destroy it is first to make us believe in it, and believe in it we do. Bright, cheerful, relentlessly educational, and constructed with loving analog artifice, Buddy initially plays its children's television conceit absolutely straight. There are no knowing winks telling us how ridiculous this all is. Talking animals, singing children, friendly household objects like Mr. Mailman and Mr. Sofa, cardboard fantasy kingdoms, and lessons about proper behavior are simply the rules of Buddy Park. But then the cracks begin to appear. By the time Casper is finished with Buddy, those cheerful life lessons have given way to something considerably darker. Blood, death, and dismemberment. Oh my! Murderous puppets, mangled bodies, and crimes against innocent children's television furniture that should frankly land somebody in prison. A candy-colored confection of comedy and fun becomes a dark horror. Now, as you'll hear Casper admit, he wants Buddy to entertain first and foremost, but he also wants viewers willing to be willing to look beneath all that brightly colored fur to find something else, which is where his development of different worlds and influences take shape, like with the beloved award-winning sci-fi novel A Wrinkle in Time and even The Wizard of Oz, which influence the buddy worlds that we see unfold. Now, as we discuss at length, Casper gives us permission to go to the dark side, as there are also lessons to be learned there as well. And as Patrick Swayze memorably taught us in Roadhouse, be nice until it's time to not be nice. With Buddy, there definitely comes a time to not be nice. Now, a wonderful part of our conversation, and a lot of you filmmakers are gonna will enjoy this part, especially if you've heard my prior interviews with cinematographer Zach Kupperstein, who is a favorite of mine and someone I've spoken to at length on some of his other films. He is cinematographer here on Buddy, and his lens prints are joyously all over the place. And on top of Zach's work, and part of Zach's work, there's also creating the analog TV world. And then the other worlds, once we go over the fence and leave the Buddy Park, and eventually find ourselves in a glossy digital land, which is also punctuated with a 5.1 soundscape versus the mono of its Buddy. The balancing act here between analog and then moving into the digital age is just fantastically done. And we cover Anna Kathleen's marvelous production design, Shauna Nova Foley's costuming, Josh Ethier's editing, and the incredible puppeteering work of Devin Ludlow and Sedwan Hooks, plus terrific voice work, including, number one, Michael Shannon voices a character in this. So watch the film and see if you can figure out who it is before you see the credits. Including a fave voicer of mine, Patton Oswalt, who is the voice of Strappy the Backpack Zipper. I love Strappy. He's a wonderful character. Then there's the score by Michael Yuzerski and standalone songs that you will hear over and over and over again in your head for days on end. This is a fun, fun film that one might even call a bit twisted. You think? So, here's writer-director Casper Kelly talking all things Buddy with me. I hope you enjoy it. I had so much fun talking with Casper, and I had so much fun watching the film, and I have seen it 3 times already. So, take a listen to Casper Kelly talking Buddy. Hey, Casper!
Yeah. Hello!
How are you?
I'm good. I just finished my coffee. I'm going to text my wife and see if she'll bring me the pot. how are you?
I'm doing fine. I'm excited to talk with you about Buddy. I know a lot of people are talking about, ooh, Barney, models off of Barney and all. You actually go back a lot deeper and further with
Thank you.
And as I'm watching this, I'm thinking immediately New Zoo Review from the early 70s. Because that really is more in keeping with what Buddy is doing with quote unquote the life lessons and through jokes and songs, more so than Barney. You've also got some H.R. Puffin stuff, Sid and Marty Croft tossed in here, and even going back even earlier into the 60s. With a lot of the local children's programming that came out of Philadelphia that really set the tone for what then expanded around the country. I'm very impressed with the fact that it's fresh, it's original, it's a very novel idea, and I love your structure so that, number one, we get the true analog television feel,
yes,
complete with vertical hold, and a compacted TV screen, no widescreen TV screens here. And you play this very straight. You don't play this as a parody or a satire. So that as you're watching this, you know, it's like, oh, this is really cute. It's an homage, New Zoo Review, blah, blah, blah. And then we slowly start to see cracks. But the cracks start with my favorite character, Wade. I hate you for what you do to Wade. I'm going to tell you that up front, Casper. I okay. just love that character of Wade. He is our entree into something is not right here. And I have to ask you, his book, his beloved book that he keeps carrying, Wrinkle in
Reality. Oh, I'm sorry. You're talking about Josh.
Is it Josh?
Yeah, Josh has the book, yeah. I'm glad you like Josh.
Okay, well, and I just love the book, which it's Wrinkle in Reality. Is this a direct takeoff on A Wrinkle in Time?
Absolutely. That movie, that show, that book.
Yeah.
Was the first time my exposure to that was you've been laying down the old shows, so you'll know about this. There was a show where they would read part of a book, and as it's being read, this guy would draw the scenes.
Yeah.
You'd watch him draw it. And it was amazing for thinking about creativity to see him bring a scene to life drawing, and it was very magical. And he did A Wrinkle in Time, and the scene, one of the scenes he did was the scene where the kids go to this very conformist suburb where every house is the exact same, and then every kid comes out and dribbles a ball at the same tempo. And that really haunted me, and I just loved that.
Yes.
So I had to go read that book. Yeah, that really stuck in me.
It is my favorite book of all time. I have read it hundreds of times. First time I read it was third grade in elementary school, and I became addicted to that book. And you're talking about Camazotz, which is where they went. I know that book backwards and forwards. So when I saw Wrinkle in Reality, and then to see how Buddy plays out, I was like, he had to be playing off of A Wrinkle in Time.
Yes.
So I'm very happy about that. Very happy about that. But I'm curious, what led you to creating this film of Buddy? This is not your run-of-the-mill concept, which is why I said it's very fresh and original and a novel idea.
Well, I guess it's important for me to, what am I trying to say? I want to express myself, and I want to, and a lot of it is these unconscious feelings that I don't even fully understand myself until I start to learn about it as I write it and finish it. And even I don't know about certain things until people tell me, oh, I think the movie is about X. And I'll be like, oh my God, you're absolutely right. You know what I mean? There's that great saying I love. If you want to know what a novel is about, the last person to ask is the author. Cause I think on a certain level, people are working, intuitively. I guess I'm ambitious. I want it to be art. I want it to be about things. I don't want it to be just a good time. I want people to have a good time. But if you want to dig deeper, I want there to be things for in the ground for you to find if you do dig deeper.
Mm-hmm. Now, once you came up with the idea for this, and I truly love how you integrated all of the life lessons for the kids. But then you give us permission, too, to go to the dark side. And we still learn from that, which is really interesting. So I love that within your story structure. But so much of this, it then rises and falls. You have your structural foundation there with your story and your characters and your life lessons. But then it falls on your incredible DP, Zach Kupperstein. I love Zach dearly. As well as your production designer, Anna Kathleen, your costumer, Shauna, the art direction to create this world. So once you had the idea for this story, you've got your script down, how did your directorial vision take hold? and bring this world to life?
That was really fun, although we didn't have a lot of time. But it was watching a lot of reference and then discussing with all those department heads you mentioned. And I don't know if you mentioned Devin Ludlow, the head puppeteer.
No, because puppeteering is separate.
Okay. Design to me, that's part of the world too. But yeah, you're right. It is because they're characters. But it was a matter. It was just kind of rolling up our sleeves, you know, thinking about color palettes and the rules of what would be in this world, what wouldn't be in this world, what colors would be in this world, and what wouldn't. And then in the other worlds, and in my mind, there's four or five worlds. That's super fun to me, which probably explains why I put four or five worlds in there, you know. And in a way, it's sort of like Too Many Cooks, where it starts shifting genres and worlds as well. Mm-hmm. I guess I just like doing that.
Well, it works, especially in something like this, where, buddy, this is a quote-unquote television show within the movie. So, you know, you've got license to do that with no questions asked. But when you create these different worlds, I really like the visual tonal bandwidth, how it shifts, which then impacts your emotional tonal bandwidth. Once we go over the fence, we get into a whole different world. Your color palette shifts. It's green, it's dark, but it's verdant and alive.
Yeah, it's wilder.
Yeah.
Oh, and one other point about that is the sound changes, too. It goes from stereo to 5.1 sound in a dramatic way.
The sound very much changes once we go over the fence. Then we get into a desert situation. And I find it very funny that we have an old covered wagon there that's broken down. And its covering says circus. And you wonder, okay, why was there a circus in the middle of the desert? But, you know, I don't know how many people are going to think that weirdly out. You bring in Clint Howard, who gets to create another bizarre character for his character closet. He is hilarious as Cowboy George, and then his sidekick, Willie, which, of course, that, theoretically, you can argue, goes all the way back to Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy. Yes. So you've got these great homages, and then you even do a wonderful homage to The Wizard of Oz, which is another whole set. And you really embrace the whole analog creation before CGI and VFX and all, with cardboard and twinkle lights behind it. Very, very analog. This whole thing is very analog, and I really love it, until we get into that third act, which is when all hell breaks loose. And we've got blood, death, and dismemberment. My God, Casper. Forget about lions, tigers, and bears. We've got blood, death, and dismemberment.
Oh, my.
But I gotta say, to kill Mr. Sofa, seriously, Casper.
I'm sorry. I apologize.
This is a really big transition in Buddy. How challenging was it moving into that third act and this climactic blood, death, and dismemberment? Because that's a huge shift. And this is where a lot of the puppeteering really takes hold with Buddy, as does the voice work.
it was challenging. This movie probably should have had quadruple the budget.
Yeah.
So a lot of death and dismemberment you're talking about, it would be like, well, you're going to get to do one of these, so you better make sure it works, because by the time we're not going to be able to clean the blood off these walls. You know,
right.
Like, you're going to get one. So I'm like, can I at least get a second camera? You know? So, yes, but it was interesting. I don't know how spoilery we can get, but it was fun to revisit the Buddy Park, but in a high resolution and with dramatic mm-hmm. lighting. You know, mm-hmm. how strange is that? You know, how unsettling is that to see the same world but with shadows?
Yeah.
Because, you know, usually it's brightly, evenly lit, you know. So that was fun to me. I had a great time doing that stuff.
You know, and this begs the question, how did you and Zach, working with Zach, how did you develop your visual grammar in terms of those transitions and going from the very analog light overhead, that's all you get, no shadows, this kind of stuff, into the quote-unquote digital world that we now, everybody takes for normal now?
Yeah, like there is a shift where we go into a world that's like our world, and I wanted that to be like a modern horror movie, like Smile. And then there's a shift that's sort of like Wizard of Oz or Oklahoma, you know. And yeah, it was a lot of Zach and I, we spent so many hours together in pre-pro and on weekends too, because we didn't have a lot of time, figuring that out. And also, he is a wonderful DP in terms of blocking.
Mm-hmm.
We really would do overhead diagrams of every set and figure out where the character's standing, where should the camera be, how can we mimic the blocking shot grammar of each sequence. And that really, I think, helped me grow as a director too. 'Cause coming up doing comedy, I did this show, You're Pretty Face Is Going to Hell, which is kind of a comedy where we would allow a lot of improv. And that really, you had to really focus more on, okay, we'll get a wide, we'll get some close-ups over the shoulder, you know, let them go. Two close-ups so they can improv off each other and we can cut back and forth. And here it was a lot more. I really wanted to be more cinematic, where Spielbergian even, where the way that you can do a scene in one or two shots, but you don't even notice it because characters are walking up to the camera. It becomes a close up.
Right.
And then they, and that was really fun and helped me grow as a director, I think.
Well, and in that third act, where probably in the last 10 minutes, you really, there's some incredible ECUs that Zach hones in on Buddy.
Oh, yes, yes.
yeah. Really fantastic. And those I know were very deliberate. They were because they're body parts. The body parts are not walking to the camera, but
yes,
they work.
No, absolutely.
They
yes.
work really, really well. Now,
thank you.
Another, I can't imagine the editing process on this for you, because you are balancing different looks. You're going analog, digital. And of course, We can't talk about the bitter end of this, because it is just way out there and it blows your mind. It is very much a reverse Big Brother is watching you idea and concept that's fantastic and plays back again to A Wrinkle in Time as Charles Wallace pops up in different worlds in the book. But
yes.
Your editing could not have been that easy. You're working with Josh Ethier. How challenging was the edit on this? Because then you also had to bring in your music and your songs that I cannot get out of my head.
Yeah. Josh is great. And we had a blast working together. And it was just a lot of hours. I mean, we didn't have a lot of time because we were rushing to submit to Sundance in October, so we hardly had any time. But thank God he was able to, he was willing to work weekends and late nights and just trying things. But editing is my favorite part of the process. It's really magic to see something come to life, and combining two shots and it creates a feeling. It's really magical. And I think I forgot the second part of your question. Forgive me.
The editing and weaving in the music and the songs.
Oh, yeah, the music, yeah. And I always go, why do I do this to myself? It's never easy, but we had two composers. We had Michael Yuzerski, who did the score,
mm-hmm.
which was tricky in its own right because it has so many genre shifts, and then also we realized Barney has wall-to-wall music in it to keep that tone, and we realized very quickly we needed that too, and he really came through on that with Flying Colors. And then secondly, the songs that the kids sing and perform in the show are by Sean Coleman, who also did the song for Too Many Cooks, and I've worked with him for a long time, and he's great. And then working on those and tweaking the lyrics and the melody and so it was a lot. Yeah, it was a tall order, but not a lot of time. But I'm very grateful we pulled it off.
The lyrics are hysterical. They are hysterical. I have had the song stuck in my head for days now. So
thank you.
Well, I know Reese wants me, she's texting me, you know, wants me to rap, but I do quickly have to ask you about the puppeteering and the puppets themselves, because some of these puppets get abused greatly, like Mr. Yes. Mailbox and even Buddy. And of course, Betty Bunny on top of that, poor Charlie the Train. Give me a broad stroke on the puppeteering and the wonder of that, because it's amazing.
It's hard to answer, but I guess I've worked with puppets a lot. I mean, they're in Smarf is in Too Many Cooks. The Cheddar Goblin is a puppet. I use puppets a lot, and I guess there's just something magical about it I love. I worked with Devin Ludlow, and I also got to mention Sedwan Hooks and Jamaica Collins. Sedwan was a Barney fanatic and really brought a lot to the design of that, and also the personality of Betty Bunny, because he was that character. And then also I want to mention Sergey, who is the suit actor for Barney, and it's a deceptively very difficult job. If you can imagine, he cannot see out of that costume unless the mouth is open.
Sure.
And as you remember, he's doing dance routines and walking downstairs. He's doing dance routines with kids and walking downstairs. It's pretty amazing. And how his body language and hand movements will match the line. So, suit actors and puppeteers. I loved it.
And I'm guessing a big part of the budget went for some of these suits, because they do kind of get bloody and destroyed.
Yeah, but we did not get I don't think we ever got doubles. We had to just shoot it in the right order. So that we could do that, yeah.
I hope...
Maybe the blood, I think we were able to wash out, but it took time, so we didn't have a lot. We didn't do that a lot, yeah.
Well, you know, New rule sells incredible washable blood for filmmakers.
Okay, good to know.
They're in the Valley. They're in Northridge. They sell incredible blood, washable blood. So for your future costume endeavors.
I'm going to have to bring you in to be an extra as a thank you for my next movie for that.
Cass,
and use that blood. I guess I'm going to have to use that blood as well. Have a kill scene for you.
I will do anything with a kill scene, Casper, let me tell you.
Okay.
But you did an amazing job with Buddy. It is so much fun. I think people are really going to love it, especially older people, even ones going back to my generation of the 60s, when these kind of shows really first started forming and taking shape. And then you just took it to the nth degree, and then at the end of the film, you just blow everybody's mind. I would love to see a sequel of some sort.
People ask me about it. I'm definitely interested. I got some ideas.
Well, put those ideas on paper, because I wouldn't mind seeing a sequel on this one, Casper.
Okay, great. I appreciate it.
Casper,
it means a lot to me.
Thank you so much for taking time to talk to me this morning about Buddy, and thank you for making Buddy, and I hope we get to talk again in the future.
Oh, you can count on that. you're in the list. You're on the list. This is a great conversation.
I'm on the list.
Great to meet you.
I love it. Okay, bye-bye.
All right, take care.
And that was writer-director Casper Kelly talking Buddy. I love Buddy. I love Buddy. Yes, I do. until I hate Buddy. I hate Buddy. Yes, I do. But I never hate the film Buddy. It's fantastic. I do so love it. And we only teased it in the interview, and I'm only going to tease it here. The ending of the film, wait until you see it. It's a real shocker, and it has a lot of tacit social commentary in it. It's a fantastic ending. And as I said, you can see Buddy for yourselves exclusively in theaters this Friday, August 28th. Now, that's two winning films for you to check out this weekend in the theater. Both of them as different as night and day. Both of them wonderful. So, that's all the time we have this week. But I'll be back next week with more interviews, more films for you to talk about. And as always, in the meantime, check out BehindTheLensOnline.net for more interviews and new movie reviews. And until next week, I'm Debbie Elias. This is Behind the Lens.